So we're in chapter 8. It's going to be pretty early in your New Testament sides of the Bible there. So we're going to go through we're going to skip the cleansing of the leper, and we're going to go right on to the centurion. For those who don't know, this is one of my favorite stories in the Bible. All right, so the centurion. When Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, imploring him and saying, "Lord, servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented." Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." Centurion said, "Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another one, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, "Truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. Say to you that many will come from the east and the west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, it shall be done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment. So it's pretty cool. This is Capernaum, right? He's coming from the Sermon on the Mount, somewhere in this region. He's coming down, he's going into Capernaum, right on the Sea of Galilee. We kind of see Capernaum multiple times in the New Testament. It's kind of Jesus' base of operations throughout the New Testament, or at least through his time. Now this is what a centurion would have looked like, right? This is his garb, he's got the feathers on top of the helmet. He's kind of a... All right, he looks like a bad man, let's be honest, right? He looks like he could do some damage. He's got the sandals, he's got the skirtish thing, right? It's kind of a loincloth of sorts, right? The breastplate, right? All the stuff that we hear when we're talking about the full armor of God, right? These are the different piece parts, right? And this is why it says to lace up your feet, right? Because... To be honest, them sandals, they don't put themselves on, right? Right. No arch support in that, all right?
I really wish they would put themselves
on. So what was a centurion? A centurion was kind of like a big officer in the Roman army, right? He's got 100 people working for him. Centurion. Century. He's got 100 people under him. Somewhere between 80 and 150. So I look at it like he's a captain of a submarine crew, right? About the same number of people. So he's kind of a big dude. He serves under a legionnaire, which is a general, right? So the legionnaire, he's got, you know, a legion. Legion was about, you know, 1,000 or so, right? It would be 10 centuries, right? But they had pretty good sized amount of power, right? They would be over top of an area like this guy. He would have been mostly in charge of Capernaum and the surrounding regions, and then there would be another century that would border him, and then another one that borders on all sides, right? And then when you got the 10 centuries together, you'd have one general basically leading all of the centurions there, and they'd go to meetings and stuff like that. So this guy's pretty big dude, right? Pretty high up there, right? One, he was a Roman citizen. Number two, he was definitely a Gentile. Right, the Jewish people were not acceptable as centurions at this time. And so, kind of a big guy, but he's also, we have to keep in mind that one, he is a Roman, and two, he is most certainly not Jewish. He is a Gentile, right? So Gentiles, they're considered unclean, and people, you know, don't be around them. And Jews were not to associate with Gentiles, period. No ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Is that why they weren't seen with the Samaritan people?
Right. They were half-breeds. They weren't full Jewish people, right? They were considered a half-breed, half-Jewish and half-other.
Because that's one of my favorite stories, too, the woman at the well.
Woman at the well, right? So... The first thing he says, and it's kind of shocking when you think about it in context, Right? The first thing this guy says is, Lord. Right? That's the first word that comes out of the mouth of the centurion. Adonai. Lord. Let's think about that in context, right? We got Thomas. This is, you know, right after the resurrection has happened. It says after 8 days, right? Thomas, he wasn't there the first time. So 8 days have passed, and Thomas was with him. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, that means locked, and stood in their midst and said, peace be with you. Doors are locked, and some dude just comes in. And peace be with you, that's the first thing he says. Then he said to Thomas, reach your finger and see my hands, and reach here with your hand and put it in my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing. And Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. Also, the way it's written could be the Lord of me, the God of me. Right? Jesus said to him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. Right? This is John 20, 26 to 29. Right? So Thomas, he accepts him as Lord and God once he sees Jesus resurrected. This centurion, he walks up. The first thing he says is, Lord. Lord, my servant is, he's dying. He's paralyzed. He's, you know, the word is kurios, right? He to whom a person or thing belongs, about which he has the power in deciding. So this guy, he comes up and he says, not Adonai, but kurios. Adonai is the Old Testament version of the same word, right? Yeah, K-U-R-I-O-S, kurios.
That's an
R in Greek. That's an R in Greek. It is. It is indeed. So, but it's something about which he has the power of deciding, right? So he says, Lord, and then he presents something he believes that Jesus has the power to decide. Lord, my servant lays in bed paralyzed, tormented, right? Centurion understands who Jesus is. He knows what the power of Jesus is before he even comes to Jesus. And he says, Lord, kurios, I know you have the power to do this. You have the power of decision over this. Thomas had to see him risen to believe in him, to believe that he was Lord. This guy just understood it. He was like, that's Lord.
Yeah, he's also a Roman citizen, right?
Right, he's a Roman, not a Jew.
Yeah.
He's a Roman, and he understands, intrinsically knows who Jesus is, right? The question is who do we say that Jesus is? Who do we believe him to be? Do we believe him to be Lord? Is he kurios? Do we treat him as such? Or do we just say, yeah, whatever, right? Is he your master, or are you your master? Are you following his decisions or your own? Have you given him this power to decide, or are you trying to do it on your own? So, and this is earlier in Matthew, right? We're going to talk about that paralyzing, right? It can mean something other than just paralyzed. Right? The news about him spread throughout all of Syria, and they brought to him all who were ill, suffering with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Right? All of this group, they fall into this paralyzed, right? No further information is given as what is wrong with the servant. Just that he falls into this group. One of these types of things, right? They've got diseases, pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics. Right? These five things. It could have been any of those. We don't really know fully what was wrong with the servant. We're not given that information. We can't just read more into it than it says. We can't say, oh, he was in bed with this. Well, we don't know that, right? We know that it could be any number of things. Could be, you know, an actual disease. It could be he was possessed. He could have been an epileptic. He could have been just paralyzed, and we don't know. So we've got to be careful not to read more into it than we have, right? But what we do know is this guy, a Roman soldier, pretty high up there, kind of taking aim at political power of some sort, is coming to a Jewish teacher and calling him Lord and asking for his servant to be healed. That's what we know. He's heard of who this Jesus guy is. He's heard of this Matthew 4 stuff, all these people being healed under Jesus' power, and he has chosen to believe. He has chosen to accept that Jesus can indeed do this. He just needs Jesus to hear him. And Jesus does. Jesus listens. We got a Jewish teacher listening to a Gentile. Unheard of in the first century. Absolutely unheard of. Nobody could have predicted that this would happen. But this man is sure that Jesus can take care of this, right? He calls him Lord, and he says, this is what you have power over. Please do this for me. Right? Jesus says, I will come. I'll come, and I'll do this. Right? By this you know that the Spirit of God, every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, is from God. Right? He's saying, I'm going to come in the flesh to you. Right? If we confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, it's from God, right? We are from God when we say that Jesus has come in the flesh. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus is not from God, confess Jesus is not from God, right? So anybody who says that, it's not necessary that he was in the flesh. It's not from God. It's absolutely not from God, right? So around Easter time last year, a president at a seminary in America said that the resurrection of Jesus is not necessary for it to be a physical resurrection. This is a president at a seminary. No, because they would, let me tell you, they would tell you 100% that it has to be in the flesh. Right? Otherwise, the Eucharist makes no sense, right? This is Union Seminary in New York, right?
Of course.
Right? But that's not from God, right? This is the spirit of the Antichrist, of which you have heard that is coming, and now it is already in the world. There are those, even by the time John's writing this, we don't know when that is, probably the late 70s, early 80s, who are saying that Jesus didn't come back in the flesh. John's like, well, that's a load because, you know, I know this personally, but if you're not confessing it, then that's the spirit of the Antichrist. And it's evident. It was clear in the first century, it's clear in the 21st century that Jesus must have risen in the flesh. If not, then the Bible is not true.
Right.
Paul says that, 1 Corinthians 15. But he has come. Right? The coming Messiah has saved us. Those who believe in him, he has saved. He has given the ability to be sons, co-heirs with Christ. If we ask things in his name, he will go before the Father on our behalf. Right? Are we going to him with our requests? Are we being like centurion and going to him with our requests? He says he will come if we go to him with our requests. He will heal. He will do these things, right? As long as it's for the benefit of the kingdom, right? Doesn't mean, hey, Jesus, I could really use $1 million right now. That Jesus is just going to open up somebody's pocketbook and give you $1 million. That's not what that means at all.
Why don't you ask Mikey? He's spreading money around like crazy.
Are we going to the world with him as our message? You know, are we willing to go the same as Christ is willing, as Christ told us to go, and the same as he was willing to come? Are we going with that same willingness? And he, but the centurion, when Jesus says, "I will come to your house and I will heal him," the centurion says, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. I am not worthy for you to come into my house." This is a Roman citizen who has political aspirations and is probably on his way up the ladder. And he says, "I'm not worthy for you to come into my house. Slow your roll, Jesus. I'm not worthy." That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Here's another person who said, "I'm not worthy." John was clothed with camel's hair and wore a leather belt around his waist, and his diet was locusts and wild honey. Now, there are two possible possibilities of this locust. It's actually the physical bug locust. Or there was also a tree which would produce a sweet-smelling flower called a locust flower. That could have been the other locust here. We don't know. Once again, to say that it's the bug is to read into it too much. To say that it's the flower for sure, to read into it too much, doesn't really tell us.
Well, maybe he ate the bug, the flower, and the honey on top of it.
Nice sandwich, right? Maybe. Right? And he was preaching, saying, "After me, one is coming who is mightier than I, and I am not fit, not worthy, to stoop down and untie the thong of his sandals."
Didn't John eat bugs?
It's John the Apostle, or John the Baptist, right?
Yeah.
That's who this is.
Oh, that's probably Lucas, then.
"I baptize you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit." Right? John realized that Jesus was coming, and he was unworthy to even be mentioned in the same conversation as Jesus. He knew this. He's like, "Yo, you guys, you've got this all twisted up. You know, Jesus is coming, and when he comes, I'm not even worthy to untie his sandals." Right? Imagine the shock on his face when Jesus said, "No, you got to baptize me."
He said, "Wait, wait,
like, whoa, 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 whoa.
You be baptizing me."
Yeah, exactly. Whoa, 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 whoa. Right? So how worthy are we? Right? John says he's not worthy. How worthy are we for Jesus to come to us?
Pretty much like, I don't know, for me.
We're guilty sinners. We do not keep the laws that God has given. We do not love God as we should. We don't keep him as our number one priority. The difference between us and the centurion is, by and large, we think we're worthy of Christ, and he knew he wasn't. What's the biggest difference between us and him? So we think we're good enough. He knew he wasn't good enough. But Jesus says to him, he says, "I'm not worthy for you to come into my house," right? Are we keeping our house in such order to which we would willingly accept Christ to come into our home? Right? Joshua had the same concerns, right? He has just led the Israel army to the promised land, right? And he says, "If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve." Are you going to serve God or something else? We have to make that choice. Has to be a choice for us on whom we're going to serve in our own home, our own house. "Whether the gods which your fathers served, which are beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living." Right? Which gods are you going to serve? These fake gods? Are you going to serve fake gods which your father served, or the fake gods of the people who were here before you? He says, "But as for me and my house, those under my house, we will serve the Lord." It's the same word as what the centurion used. I mean, it's the Hebrew version of the same word, right? But it's the same word, right? We're going to serve God Almighty. We're not going to serve these false idols. How many false idols do we serve on a daily basis? I mean, once heard a guy say, you know, our God is our stomachs. We've got a restaurant on every corner with which to worship. Our gods are our sports teams. We build billion-dollar cathedrals with which to go and worship. Our gods are our televisions, and we arrange the chairs in such a way that everyone can worship at the same time. Well, I'm not picking on them. That's from somebody else. That's not from me. Right? Who are you worshiping on a daily basis? Whom have you given authority in your lives? Mark 11, right? They began reasoning among themselves, saying, right? So Jesus has said, right? Hey, who did John the Baptist have the authority from? Was that from God or was that from man? And they're like, oh, whoa. If we say from heaven, he will say, then why did you not believe him? If we say from men, for they were afraid of the people, for everyone considered John to have been a real prophet, answering Jesus, they said, we do not know. We don't know where John the Baptist got his authority from. Right? And Jesus said to them, Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Yes, I have authority to do these things, to cast out demons, to heal the sick, to tell you when you are hosed. Right? He's kind of mocking them. Right? He's mocking them here. He's like, oh, you want to know where my authority comes from? Okay, you tell me where John the Baptist got his authority, and I'll tell you where I get mine. Right? Was it from heaven or from men? They're like, well, we don't know. He's like, well, because you don't know, because you are afraid of the people more so than you're afraid of God, I'm not going to tell you where my authority comes from. Are we more afraid of people than we are of God? So whose authority is it? He who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has one who judges him. You reject Jesus? There's one who judges you. Note, he says one, right?
That's Jesus.
The word I spoke is what will judge him at the last day. For I did not speak of my own initiative, my own authority, but the Father himself who sent me has given me a commandment as to what to say and what to speak. I am going to speak on the authority of the Father because that's who has given it to me. Right? So it's the Father's authority in which Jesus is going forth. That's whose authority which Jesus is doing these healings, which Jesus is doing the teachings, which is leading Jesus to drive people out of the temple. It's the authority of God is what, that's whose authority he's exercising. Now who can exercise the authority of God? Well, God. This is also Jesus claiming to be God. We may not see that in our own terms. We're like, so what? Right? But I'll tell you that, you know, this guy's like, I'm a man under authority, right? I give orders. I say to this one, go, and he goes. I say to this one, come here, and he comes. Right? I say to this one, do this, and he does it. I'm a man under authority. Now, is he under his own authority? No, he's under Caesar's. But if somebody says no to him, whose authority do you think provides this smackdown? Caesar's. So he's operating under someone else's authority. Doesn't make him Caesar. But man, it's treated like it if you don't listen.
Yeah, that's for sure.
One who has authority gives orders. Right? He says, I'm a man under authority. I give the order and it happens. You're a man under authority. You give an order and it happens. That's what he's saying to him, right? If one gives order, they reissue them. If one is given an order, they reissue them under their subordinates, right? So I get an order from my boss. I tell my guys, hey, do this. And they do it. That's what this guy's talking about. Yep. Jesus said he's given orders under the authority of God. Everything Jesus is commanding is under God's authority. He says, I do nothing under my own authority. Right? This guy says, I say to this one, go, and he goes. This one, come, and he comes. Right? God's number one directive to everyone is to go. Right? We see that throughout the Bible. Hundreds of times, God gives the order to go. Right? He told Moses to go to Pharaoh. Moses said, yeah, I don't know that I'm the guy you want. And he's like, yeah.
He's like, I'm
not a good speaker, God. And God said, well, I'll send somebody to be your mouthpiece. You know, God, they don't really like me over there. I don't really care.
Thank you.
He told Joshua to go to the promised land. He said, hey, well, Moses, he ain't making it. Go into the promised land. Right? Tells Isaiah to go to the people. Go to the people. They're not going to listen to you. They're not going to do what you tell them. But go to the people anyways. He tells Jonah to go to the Ninevites.
Yeah, that'd
be more. He's like, Jonah, go to Nineveh. And he's like, to where? That's not in Israel. He says, no, I know. Go. And he's like, I don't think so. You know? He ended up going.
Yeah, after the whale of a tale.
Tells Elijah to go into the wilderness and pray. Right? Elijah prays, and what happens? We get a drought. Tells Elijah to pray, and what do we get? Rain. Tells the disciples to go into the world. Tells Peter to go to the centurion, right? Peter's up and he's praying in Acts, and you know, he's got this dream vision thing going on, and the sheet gets lowered in front of him, and he's like, get up, Peter, kill and eat. And he's like, I've never eaten anything that's unclean. And he's like, whoa, how dare you call anything that I've created unclean? And he's talking about, Peter, go to the centurion. Go to this guy, Cornelius. Tell him who I am. Peter goes. And the whole house is saved. That means the man, his wife, his kids, and all of his servants. Because he had them all sit in and listen to Peter. Even his servants, his slaves. Has them listen to Peter too. And the whole house was baptized. Tells Paul to go to the Gentiles. You know, Paul, I know that you're kind of raising up in the ranks of Jewish leadership, but here's the plan. You're going to go to these people who don't know who God is, and you're going to tell them who God is. You know, I mean, there's Paul, you know, philosopher of philosophers in the first century, and he goes to where any great philosopher in the first century would go. That's to the Areopagus. It's this place in Athens where they would basically sit around and just, they would talk for talking's sake for the most part. They exchange ideas. And there's Paul, putting God in the marketplace of ideas. He tells us to go. He tells us to go multiple times. Preach the word, be instant in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, and exhort with all longsuffering and great doctrine. Right? Always be prepared to give a defense for the hope that is in you, yet do so with gentleness and reverence. These are commands for us to go into the world and place Christ in the marketplace of ideas. It's a command for us to go. Are we listening to the one who gave us the orders? The centurion was able to give orders. And he would listen, because if he didn't listen, you know what would happen to him? He'd find a rapid way to remove head from shoulders. And he says, all you got to do, Jesus, is give the word, and it will happen. Right? Give the word, and it will happen. Right? Jesus says, "Behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me, to render to every man according to what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. He is the great I am." Been around for a whole long time. Right? The Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. He's been around since the beginning. Right? Yet, having been around Israel since the beginning, he's never seen such great faith in God. Jesus is saying, "I've been around forever. Yet I have not seen so great a faith in Israel. In all of Israel. In all of time, in all of Israel, I've not seen so great a faith as this guy. This Gentile who is coming up to me, not believing in our God, in God Almighty. No. But he's got greater faith than all y'all in who I am." The soldier is best suited. Is the best suited to show faith, right? He's a man of action. He's going in and he's acting on this faith that he has in who Christ is and what Christ can do. Man who's ready to act on a moment's notice. Are we? Are we ready to go? To go? Right? Are we ready to go? Are we ready to act on what Christ has called us to act on? Are we ready to show Christ how great our faith is? Are we doing that? Are we living by faith? We live in how we want to live. You know, there are plenty of reasons to have faith in God. Plenty of them, right? He's a creator. He's the designer. He's the giver of life. He brought life from non-life. No matter what you believe in with regards to evolution, you still have to get from life to, you still have to get life from non-life. Because it can't go back forever. Because that isn't even possible. Right? He's the giver of life. And most importantly, he is. Nothing greater can be conceived than God. Jesus says, "Many will come and recline at the table of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Right? And in Matthew 24, he says, "And Jesus answered and said to them, see to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many." Many will come, saying that I am the Christ, and will mislead many. "You'll be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not frightened, for those things must take place. But this is not yet the end." Even when there's wars and rumors of wars and there's earthquakes and all of this, it's not yet the end. "For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes." Right? This is Matthew 24, 4 through 7, right? He's talking about the end of times. "But many will come in his name." Right? Many will recline at the table. "But not everyone who reclines at the table will make it." That's what he says here to the centurion, right? He says, "I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out." They'll be cast out. We got to be careful. "Many will come as if they're his servants. Those who say they are coming in Christ's name, they're going to come." We got to test them against the known orders of the commander. Right? We know what the commander has given us. He's written it down. It's right here. The orders of the commander are here. If the orders that this individual comes, he's a bad messenger. This is what's called the commander's intent. The commander puts out his intent and says, "This is our goal here." That's a military thing. Right? The commander puts out this, here's my goal for this year, or this 2 years, or while I'm in command, this is what I want to see. Right? So we gotta measure what words are being spoken against the commander's intent. Right? Does our goal make sense? Right? Do the things we hear from these people who are coming as messengers of God, do they match what Jesus said in the Bible? Or are they just saying what they want? Right? He's warning here that many will come, yet that their faith is not great. They don't believe in Christ. They don't have faith in what God is doing, so they're doing their own thing. They're commanding their own desires, their own goals. Right? Talks about casting them out. Jude wrote about that, and he says, these are the men who are hidden reefs in your love feasts, when they feast with you without fear, caring for themselves, their clouds without water, carried along by winds, autumn trees without fruit, doubly dead, uprooted, wild waves of the sea, casting up their own shame like foam, wandering stars for whom the black darkness has been reserved forever. This is that outer dark. I will cast them into the outer darkness, and there will be weeping and gnashing of the teeth. Who? Clouds without water, those who are carried along by winds, their autumn trees without fruit, they're doubly dead, their wild waves casting up their own shame like foam, their wandering stars. They're not following what the commander has given for orders. Really? We got to hear about this again? We're going to hear about false teachers even when Jesus is talking about the great faith of the centurion? Yes, because he says that many are going to come. They're going to recline, quote unquote, recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But they're not, because they're going to be cast out. Because they're not doing what God has called them to do. There's more people who will not see heaven. So why do we have to hear about this so much? Because ensuring that we are only listening to the right gospel is important. That's Galatians 1:5. Right? There will be all other gospels coming, right? Not real gospels, not the right gospel, not the truth, but other gospels. And they'll be brought by teachers. They're not good teachers, but they're teachers. Right? If we get it wrong, if we get wrong what the gospel is, we stand to lose everything. People want to say that this guy named Blaise Pascal, he was a mathematician, they want to say that his wager is not a good argument for the existence of God. And I agree, it's not. But it does show us, if all things being equal within evidence are the same, we stand to lose everything if we go in the wrong direction. If we put our money on no God and he's real, we stand to lose everything. But if we get it wrong, we stand to lose eternity. Eternity in the presence of God. Right? And it will be done. Right? Jesus says, it will be done for you as you have believed. Matching your faith in who I am, it will be done. Right? Truly, truly, I say to you, he who believes in me and the works that I do, he will do also. And greater works than these he will do, because I go to the Father. Whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, so the Father may be glorified in the Son. Why will Jesus do it? Because the Father may be glorified. He's not going to do it for your glory, for your honor, so you get praise. He's going to do it so God gets praised. So God gets the glory. He doesn't do it for us. He does it for God to get the glory. That's got to be what our life is about. Why does he say yes? Because God gets the glory. Why does he say no? Because God gets the glory. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. Right? Specific caveat, though, is that God gets the glory. Right? And at that moment, the servant was healed. Now, one of the things we don't read here is how do we know that it was at that moment, right? So, servant gets healed. Another servant's coming from the house towards him. Servant gets healed. He heads toward Jesus. Where do they meet up? It says in another gospel, they meet halfway, when he was halfway home. Well, if he's traveling at the same speed as this guy, they meet in the middle, right? He even asks him, what time? And he says that it was the same time in which Jesus had said it would be done. Right? So, we kind of have these, it's called an unintended consequence, right? You know, Luke records it, Matthew records it, they both record the same thing, but we don't know how he knows that it happened at that time. Because Matthew clearly says he was healed at that time. And the servant was healed that very moment. It's crazy how the Bible can be used to paint two pictures together into one. Right? There are other places like that. And we're gonna go through a lot of them in Easter, but you know, there are places in the Bible that are a lot like that, where it's just two happy consequences come together and it paints the whole picture. You know, it's kind of like when the guards were beating Jesus. In one of the Gospels, it says that, you know, it doesn't tell you about him being blindfolded. It just says they were beating him, and they're like, prophesy who hit you! Well, that's easy if he's not blindfolded. But in another one, it says that he had a blindfold on. And then you're like, oh, now I see why that's important. Right? Because there was a blindfold there. Now, that one doesn't tell you about prophecy. Prophesy who hit you. So, those are unintended, right, kind of corroborations. It's kind of like you would see in a court of law, right? One guy has part of a story, one guy has another part of the story, and the truth is there, all of it. You just got to put the whole story together. Right? But we know that at that very moment, the servant was healed. This is kind of the first big instance we see of a Gentile coming to Jesus and saying, hey, you know, I need some help. My servant is dying. Heal him, please. And he's like, all right, well, let's go. And he's like, no. I'm not worthy for you. And Jesus is amazed. It even says he marveled. Right? Jesus is amazed by this guy's testimony of who Jesus is. He took the evidence, he put it together, and he said, this guy can heal my servant. He doesn't even need to go. If he can just issue the order, he's like me. Just issue the order and it's done. Right? He's the Lord over it. The question is this where our faith stands? Does our faith stand like the centurion's? Does our faith recognize Christ as Lord over all? I encourage you to look into what does that mean? What does it mean for me to give control of something to Christ? How does that look, and how can I do that in my everyday life? Give God control over what's His. Over what's in his control. Let's pray.